Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to another Tech Talk from RNIB Connect Radio, our weekly look at what's going on in the technology world from a blind and partially sighted perspective. It's your program, so if you want to get in touch, is there anything you want us to talk about or anything we could help you out with, you can drop us an email or a voice message to techtalk@rnib.org.uk. That's T-E-C-H-T-A-L-K at rnib.org.uk. Coming up this week, as part of the celebrations for Global Accessibility Awareness Day, we'll be speaking to Corb O'Connor, the Director of Accessibility Advocacy at Level Access, to talk about both the current state and the future of accessible technology. We'll be hearing about the new speech label product from Hable, and we'll have a special preview of the upcoming Sight Village Leeds exhibition. The usual team joining me this week, Hubert Bavalkovich, Jackie Brown and Natalie Curran. Let's see what's going on with everyone. Hubert, what have you got?
For me, it's a small app recommendation. Cozy Sort Studio is the app I'm talking about. And it's a very relaxed, no-time-pressure puzzle game which involves decorating a house by placing items in appropriate areas. That's all I kind of figured out from a brief playing with it. I managed to decorate a tea shelf, apparently, with some various household items. So nice. It's kind of, I describe it as a game when you come back from a very long day at work and you just want something low-key to kind of play around with because you're bored before bed or something like that. I think that game's quite nice. Plus, if you like kind of decorating houses a bit, you can maybe play around with that. It's not massive kind of like Sims style by any means, quite the opposite, but it's quite nice. Just, I think the name's quite right to call it Cozy Sword Studio. It's a cozy little puzzle. If you're looking for a good time killer and you don't have much else going on and you don't want something exhausting, it's fully accessible, so do give it a try. It's got various accessibility options. Voiceover kind of options are always enabled, but you can enable contrast and a few other things like that to help you a bit as well. So that's my little recommendation for today.
It feels like these sort of things are picking up quite a bit, like these sort of cozy, like more relaxed games. Like we've got Land of Livia as well. Is it the, what's the other one? Is it Art of Fauna or something?
Art of Fauna and Art of Flora. They've got both versions. I quite like that because it's just, I like a game which you can put away. You don't play a bit and put away and you're not impacted negatively by not playing 24/7.
Yeah.
That's the kind of games I like.
It's just the time aspect for me. Like, I don't really have time to get into a proper, like, addictive game.
Well, that's exactly the same for me. I only get back from work in the evening, have my dinner, and I've got about an hour or two to do stuff I like before I need to go to bed again. So it's actually quite nice to have a game where you don't have to commit loads of time.
I mean, for me, it's having a kid. You know, we've got a one-year-old, so by the time we put him to bed, we're ready for bed by that point, honestly.
Yeah.
There you go, a nice little, is it free, that, or is it? Is
it, yes, paid? It is, yes.
Very nice. Yeah, there's one to give a try if you're looking for something like that. Jackie, anything caught your eye this week?
Last week I said that there was this ad sort of thing that jumped up on ITVX app when you launched it, and it said something along the lines of skip to the good stuff, and you couldn't skip to anything. It didn't matter what I did with it. It wouldn't go away, so I couldn't actually get into the app. But now I see this week it has gone. And I found that going into the app to do a catch up with a TV program, I was able to go in straight away and, you know, search for the audio description and stuff. So that has gone, and I'm really pleased about that. So that's just a follow-up from last week. Also, this week there has been a new Jaws release for Jaws 2026. They have put back Page Explorer, which I believe was removed for home users, but that is now back, I think, in the Jaws 2026 update. There is also age restrictions for AI features. So if you are over 18, it won't impact you, but if you are under 18, there are restrictions in the AI sections of JAWS, and this is really kind of the way that a lot of the vendors are going down this road. We've had this topic on here before about iOS with age verification. So there is some of that in JAWS if you're under 18. And I believe that if you use WhatsApp on the PC, you can now get JAWS to read out your messages when they come in. So I think, Hubert, you might be happy with that.
I don't actually use WhatsApp on the PC much.
I don't either, but
Oh, I love it. I love WhatsApp on the PC. Mind you, I'm kind of spoiled because I've got Lisa. So you get kind of a few WhatsApp scripts built in,
yes, you
which
do.
makes it more accessible. I hear without those, I've never tried it without the Lisa scripts that you get, but I hear without those it is a bit of a pain in the backside, let's say, to navigate.
I don't use WhatsApp on the PC at all. I just use it on my phone. I think what interests me though about all these kind of updates is, do people actually read word for word when you hear of a new update coming out, whether it be for your JAWS screen reader, your NVDA, Narrator even, iOS, Android, whatever it may be. Do people read everything about the new features, or do you just go ahead, install it? Well, there's an update, so I'm just going to take it. I must be honest, I do it to a certain extent with JAWS, because I'm using it all the time, and there are a lot of features, of course, that JAWS has that I wouldn't necessarily bother about, but I just take the updates, because I think, well, I'm using Microsoft applications and I'm using web browsers. There is quite a lot in JAWS that, could be fixed. And I think, well, I'll just take the updates. And I tend to do it with iOS. But when it comes to individual apps, you have to be a little bit more cautious because if you've got an app that really works well and then suddenly there's a new update to it and it sort of breaks it, then, you have to decide whether you want to go with that update or not. So I just wonder what people think about that. Do you just take everything as it comes in and just go, yeah, click, 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 install, update, and that's it, done? Or do you sit and you really study the update paraphernalia that comes out normally with major updates?
For me, I have done it a few times with iOS. I mean, they do make it easier with a small summary on the main screen. But even when I've read the more detailed descriptions, as you've just described, Jackie, like in for a specific app update or whatever it is, software in general, sometimes the description isn't actually that helpful. Or they'll talk about, we've made the styling better, we've improved this, we've improved that, and they really focus on the visuals. And I don't know, and I don't know how anybody can know until you actually install the app, if you know if it's going to break anything for you as a voiceover user or as a Zoom user. So I've kind of given up a little bit. What I do with iOS updates at least is I tend not to do them straight away. I tend to give it at least a couple of weeks to hear if there's been any outrage caused by them. But yeah, that's my personal experience of it.
I'm a little bit like you, to be fair, Jackie. Like, if iOS updates come out, or if JAWS or NVDA updates come out, then yeah, I do read those release notes. For other stuff, like, I tend not to. I mean, Microsoft apps, you don't even know they've updated
Oh,
nowadays. You just go in
exactly.
and it's all changed. You're like, oh, right, okay, great. Yeah, that's nice.
Or they try and install Outlook, the new Outlook, or something like that. Yeah.
I think we do. I think we do look at this sort of stuff because we're into this, but I think normal people just take it. And by normal people, I mean like people who aren't necessarily techies. It's just this pop-up comes up that gets in the way, and it's like, you need to do an update, and people will either click off it or they'll just go, yeah, all right, whatever. Yeah, take the update. And then I get people ringing me up going, my phone looks different. What's going on? With this JAWS thing though, like, where do you start with this one? I feel like we need more of a bit more time to have a discussion on this one. I mean, AI, like being 18 plus to access the AI features. I didn't know about that one. I did just get a pop-up with an update this morning, but I haven't done it yet because we were about to do this and who knows what could have broken taking an update just before the recording. But I didn't know about that. It's not credit card or driver's license to verify, is it?
No, not that I know of. I mean, I haven't really played with it. I only updated mine yesterday evening, which is obviously the eve of this recording. I just updated it and that was it for me. I haven't had time yet to play with the AI, but apparently, according to what Freedom's website says, it won't affect you anyway if you're over 18. So I guess the question is, how does it know that you're...
Interesting.
Yeah.
That we'll definitely keep an eye on. Good to hear that Page Explorer is back, though. So for those who don't know, this is like a...
Yeah.
This is kind of like an AI system that tries to make pages more accessible. Essentially, I think it sort of uses AI to re-render the page almost and just give you a bit of a summary of what's on the page. And you can say, like... is there a download link? And it will say, yes, there is a download link. It looks like it's under this particular heading or something. So it'll give you a bit more of a... I don't think it can control the page, but if you're struggling to work out the layout of it, then it can give you a bit more of a guidance to what the page looks like and where you might be able to find things. So it's a pretty cool feature.
I think what had happened, it actually was released before, I think, Freedom or Vespero decided... it would have to be like rolled out to certain versions. I think that's how it worked. And I think they've changed their mind and done away with that. So I think it's now incorporated in all the JAWS releases.
Yeah, awesome. I'll be having to play with that if I can get my age verified. I don't know how that's going to work, but we'll see. Natalie, have you got anything?
Kind of the usual for me in terms of it's kind of small things. Jackie's actually just reminded me of something very small and very generic, which was this week I was buying a train ticket, but I was having to do it on our work app, so not like Trainline or one of those sort of standard apps most people use. And I was having a problem with, I couldn't progress to the next page because the keyboard wouldn't go away. So it was one of those ones where I had to enter my phone number, so I typed it in, and then the done button, the next button, whatever, just was no longer there. I don't know how you're supposed to do it even visually. So what I was going to say to people is, if you're ever in that situation, what I have done before sometimes can work is I'll go back to our previous fields and that will then sort of bring up those hidden buttons. What I actually did in this situation, because that wasn't working, was up at the top, there were sort of the next stages of the process, which were grayed out, they were announcing as dimmed, and I clicked on one of those, and obviously because it wasn't available it didn't move me forward or do anything, but it did get rid of the keyboard and meant that I could hit the next or continue button. So I just thought I'd flag that as a, like I say, it's very generic, but it's kind of one of those ones when you're really stuck, that's a really useful thing to know.
Ah, nice. Something that I found to work, and I don't know if this is a recent thing. I think it's one of those things that I discovered by accident. But if it really won't go away, and again, this might not work in all apps, but if you put focus, voiceover focus on the keyboard, and then do like the two-finger scrub gesture, which is a bit of a hard one. It's sort of, or a hard one to describe at least. You sort of, it's like the back gesture. So you just sort of go up and down a few times with two fingers on the screen. Sometimes, if focus is... usually that takes you back to the previous screen, but if the focus is specifically on the keyboard, it seems to hide it sometimes. You've got to be careful because sometimes it can just throw you back to the previous screen, which to be fair is what it's supposed to do, but yeah, sometimes that can just hide the keyboard.
I think I did try that. I didn't know that that would work, but it was kind of one of those ones, a bit like Jackie with that screen that was taking up everything and she couldn't get rid of it on ITVX. I tried various combinations, you know, scrolling up, down, scrub, and it was just really stubborn, it wasn't going. And that was something I found that worked, and I didn't want to leave it and come back with sighted assistance, because you know what it's like when you're halfway through a process, so there's no way you're going to remember all the information I've already given you, and I'm going to have to start again.
I was just going to say, isn't it funny the things that we just get used to, like If that was something for a sighted person that wasn't working, they'd just go, all right, fine, whatever, forget it. We're sort of like, okay, this isn't working. Yeah, I'll try this weird gesture. I'll try this obscure thing. I'll try screen recognition. Okay, that's also not working. Right, okay. Yeah. we'll happily spend, well, maybe not happily, but we'll quite easily spend 10 minutes just figuring out how to, you know, get rid of a keyboard. Yeah, that's fine. That's just the joys.
Yeah. The other thing I've got to mention is, in a similar vein, actually, is the mail app on iOS. I know I'm maybe a bit unusual here in that I still use that. But I don't know if this was just a one-off quirk for me, but I thought I'd flag it with people again in case you fall foul of this. I was typing in a name in the copy box, the CC box, and I was expecting options to sort of auto-populate, and they weren't. I thought, okay, this is annoying. So I swiped around a bit, and I found the add contact button, and I thought, you know, click that, and I'll get the person I want from my address book. It sent the email.
Oh.
Oof. Wow.
Oh, that's annoying. Yeah.
That's terrifying.
Luckily, the email didn't have anything in it other than my signature, because I was doing the CC bit, you know, before I actually typed anything. But I thought, that's very irritating. And I'm really, really glad that that's all that I sent. Because if I'd sent half an email or maybe a slightly grumpy version of an email that I'd written before I'd smoothed out the edges, that could have been very embarrassing. So I thought I'd flag that one.
That's that's bad. If that's where it said add contact, but it was actually on the, or at least actioned the send button.
Yes, and in terms of where it was,
okay,
on the screen or like in the focus order, add contact was logical, made sense.
Yeah.
And then I heard the little noise that my email sent, and I was like, that shouldn't have happened.
I'll have to try that just as an experiment. Wow. And see what happens.
See, I always have the same problem because my signature goes in. Because if you've got an empty message, it will tell you, you know, this message has no content. Are you sure you want to send it? But because my signature goes in first, it just, yeah, if you're right, if you accidentally click send, it just fires it off.
And also in this case, it was a reply.
Yeah.
So even if your signature is blank, I think it might still send that.
Oh, yeah.
Because the previous email is considered part of that content.
I think it does, yeah.
Another thing I've noticed on the mail app with iOS, I don't know if people have discovered this or not, but you very often see if somebody's used their iPhone to send a message, you open your email message in Outlook, say, and the all you see is the from field, and then you have to scroll right down the email to get to the last message that they sent in the thread. And I've discovered how this happens. So what I do in mail, if I'm answering an email on my phone in the mail app, Apple's mail app, is when I get to the body of the message, I too have got a signature in. And so I always double tap the body, the edit field, and it says insert at end, and I make sure I double tap it so that it goes insert at start, because if you sometimes don't do that, you could well find that your message, when the recipient receives it, is buried somewhere at the bottom. So I always make a point in the edit field of the message in the body is tapping it with a double tap. And it will say insert point at start, and that's where you want it to be, because you're then going to reply, you know, with your signature underneath it. But if you don't always do that, I have seen it that your message would end up being buried somewhere. Has anybody else noticed that?
I've noticed that behavior personally, Jackie, in that, like you, I always double tap to get it back up to the top where it's meant to be.
Yeah.
I've never had the problem where I received an email from somebody where, as you say, their response is stuck somewhere down at the bottom, or
yeah.
Likewise, I don't think I have ever sent an email, or might have and not known about it, where I've made that mistake, because it's one of those things I've just always checked. I don't know why. Maybe I just heard it the first time and thought, oh, let's move this.
Yeah, it's a good habit to get into.
Yeah, I think I've done it by accident before, and someone couldn't find, they saw that I'd replied but couldn't find the message, and when I looked, they'd done that. So yeah, try and make that a habit. Just checking that insertion point thing on VoiceOver. So we spoke to Steve Nutt last week about some of the new updates coming to Android, and we've had the Android, Google had their Android show this week. I think this is just a build up to their Google I/O event, which is kind of like the main event that they're doing. But we got a few little details, which I won't go into too much, but there was a few bits. So we know that the Chromebook is now going to be almost rebranded, I guess, to the Google Book. And again, not a huge amount of detail, but it sounds to me like they're making it a bit of a mixture between a laptop and an Android tablet, like an Android device. Interesting timing to do that with Apple coming out with the MacBook Neo, because Chromebooks, from what I hear, they're massive in education. So, interesting timing there. There was one thing which I think overall is quite a small thing that really stood out to me, and that is obviously more features and more functionality coming to Gemini. And one of the things was, we spoke about widgets before on iOS. One of the things you can do with Android now coming up in Android 17 is apparently you can be able to use Gemini to create widgets. So you could be able, like, say to Gemini, either type in or speak to it and say, I want a widget from this app that only shows this information. So say it was like a transport app, but you just wanted to know about buses departing or leaving this particular stop. You didn't want to necessarily know about the ones in your location. You just wanted to know from a certain stop that you always go to or something like that. You could type into it, I want a widget that from this app that shows all buses departing from this particular stop, and it will create it for you. I love the sound of that because there's so many widgets. I mean, and I'm talking about iOS here. Android might be more flexible generally in this, but there's so many widgets in iOS that are good, but just not quite customizable enough, to give me the information that I actually want.
That sounds cool.
So I'm looking forward to that. I really love the sound of that. Well, you know what it's like in technology. There's always something going on, so a lot for us to get into. Stick with us. This is Tech Talk. This Global Accessibility Awareness Day, we're speaking with Corb O'Connor from Level Access. Before we get into it, just to give you a bit of background, Level Access help organizations to create accessible and legally compliant websites, mobile apps, software, and other digital experiences. They've been around and been doing this since 1999. And Corb O'Connor is their Director of Thought Leadership and joins me now. Corb, welcome to Connect Radio. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We're here obviously talking about digital accessibility and Global Accessibility Awareness Day. Just give us an idea of where we are now. What's the current landscape when it comes to this?
What we're seeing is that more and more organizations are investing in digital accessibility, and they're doing it for what I would consider to be the best reason of all, which is wanting to attract people with disabilities and blind folks like myself into their customer base or into their user base. Very few, I know the US has a reputation of being a place where lawsuits reign supreme. But, I think that more organizations we talk with say, yeah, that's out there. We certainly want to protect our risk profile. But really, we know that accessible experiences are better for everyone. They're more adaptable. They are going to last longer from a code perspective. They're leaner in code. And they also help us to attract a greater customer base, whether that's we want to do business with universities and cities and counties and states that are requiring digital accessibility, sure. But also, we know that because of our experience in this space, that more people will benefit and therefore will succeed as an organization when more people can interact with our content.
So, what kind of ways have you seen businesses making themselves more accessible?
You know, I would say that we are seeing certainly a push toward more accessible websites and apps in the sense of wanting to reduce the number of issues that they are creating in their new experiences. I think that more organizations are realizing that there's a lot of legacy content out on their website that really doesn't belong on a website. So a real simplification of the user experience. And as they're doing that, they're saying, how do we clean up our navigation? How do we make it easier for people to find what they need, particularly in the age of AI? And I think that certainly there are organizations saying, well, do we even need all of this out there anymore? We've got AI to solve it for us. But recognizing that most users are still not using AI in the ways that futurists and tech geeks like us might be using AI. And so they're recognizing that they still need to think about that average user and the average user experience and really focus on what is it that makes for a good experience, especially when you think of an omnichannel experience, right? It's not just about I'm interacting with your website, but it might be that I'm interacting with your website at the start of the experience. Then I'm going into a physical location, whether that's to buy a product or to pick up the product that I bought online, or it's the thing that you ship out to me. But then I'm going to go back to a digital channel for support or to do something with this product at the end of the day. I might do my research about what washing machine I'm going to buy, but at some point, especially as a blind person, I'm going to want to get my hands on the product. So I'm going to go into a bricks and mortar location, and maybe I'll want to use my app to interact with this washing machine, but I still want the ability, just like all, you know, we haven't removed all the user interface from the washing machine in terms of touchscreen controls. Sighted folks and people without disabilities still want to be able to touch buttons on their machine. They don't want to always have to go grab their phone. And so recognizing that blind folks are in that same boat, we're still thinking about things like braille labels or speech output or tactily discernible buttons on that physical device. And then especially knowing that, okay, yeah, we want to have all the automation features that an app can give us. And so people are still wanting the best of both worlds in that regard.
You know, you mentioned AI there, and we're going to come to that in a bit more detail in a little bit. But it's so funny you say that. It's a little bit off topic, but it's so funny you say about people aren't using AI in the way that probably me and you and maybe some people listening to this are. I mean, I was talking to someone who they were talking about the accessibility, like how difficult it is to flick through Google search results and some of the inaccessible websites you get that come up, and I said, well, you know, have you tried using sort of ChatGPT or Gemini or something like that? And they were sort of, oh, no, I don't wanna do that. I don't know anything about that. But then, kind of in the same breath, they were saying they just use the Google AI overview for an answer now that comes up, which of course that in a way is, well, it is Gemini. You know, they're using it without even noticing.
I agree with you entirely. You know, and I was trying to learn some Polish words the other day, and I haven't seen AI hallucinate badly more than maybe two or three times in the last year. But even the Gemini search result of trying to just translate some common words into Polish was pretty terrible. You know, it reminds me though of being at a restaurant last summer, and I scanned a menu and thought, man, these drinks look really interesting. And I asked my waiter for one of them, and he said, what are you talking about? I said, oh, you know, it's the drink that has, maybe I misread it. It has these ingredients. And he's like, that sounds like a delicious drink that we've never served. And I said, oh, okay. How about this one? He's like, nope, not that one either. And so, you know, I think that people are hearing about those kinds of experiences, which for me, as someone who uses AI apps on a regular basis, are very rare. Two or three times in the last year, for the number of times I've used a Seeing AI, a Be My AI, a Gemini, a ChatGPT, pretty good. But they hear about those experiences and they say, yeah, no, I think I'm pretty good with the certainty that I can get from the results that I can reach and that I know how to use on a regular basis.
Yeah, absolutely. Going back on to the accessibility topic, though, Level Access, of course, do a lot of work in this area with their State of Digital Accessibility report. What are some of the trends of that that you're starting to notice?
Yeah, you know, so we interview 1,600 digital experience professionals on an annual basis. This is the latest report that we did, came out in December. We've been doing it since 2019, and we have about half and half between, you know, North America and Europe. And what we find is that organizations are still connecting digital accessibility to increases in customer satisfaction or revenue growth, that sort of thing. But what's really fascinating to me is to see how many organizations have a dedicated budget, an accessibility policy, and an accountable party for their digital accessibility process. You know, that's 9 in 10 of those in Europe that are saying they have all three markers of a successful digital accessibility program. You know, more than 2/3 say they're planning to increase their spend on digital accessibility. But there's a really interesting conflict that came out in this year's data. So if we ask those people, how confident are you in the accessibility of your primary digital experience, you know, your .com or your mobile app, 92% of them are saying they are confident that that is accessible. And yet 59% are saying that they are fearing legal or regulatory action in the next year. You know, we've done a great job of telling people the European Accessibility Act is coming. And even if you're not, you know, in the Eurozone with the European Accessibility Act, it applies to you. You know, 3/4 of folks say it applies to them. And yet, only a little more than a third, a little less than 4 in 10, are saying that they're compliant with the European Accessibility Act. And so it's amazing to me that we have all these organizations with the right markers in place. They're planning to increase or maintain their digital accessibility spend. They're connecting it to all these business levers, and yet they still haven't hit the mark of an accessible digital experience. And so, you know, that mirrors the data that we saw out of WebAIM that came out just last month. That's a group at Utah State University. They did a top 1 million homepages survey, and they found for the first time we're actually going backward and homepages are becoming less accessible. And I think one of the markers of that is AI, right? We can build this great experience with AI, as we've done in lots of ways before. But in the past, we'd say, well, we never thought about accessibility. But we think, well, as long as I tell AI to make my site accessible, I'm going to make it so that everyone can use it. And really what we find is it's actually less accessible than it was with the ways that we were developing, which weren't great either, but the ways that we were developing even just a year ago.
So you mentioned there about the European Accessibility Act and organizations trying to sort of increase their spend on accessibility. What do you think is the drive for that? Does that come from users speaking out, or is it ultimately from organizations and from these regulations having a bit more enforcement of it?
I have to say that it's both, but I do think that a good law with some good penalties usually moves the needle on access generally. And so more than fines, which has been the way that most countries have taken to addressing digital accessibility. Frankly, businesses say, that's fine. We get fined every day. We get sued every day. Not worried about it. We can pay the fine. But when the penalty is, hey, you could be stopped from doing business in the EU, that's what got companies to really pay attention, that this law is different. And to see that every Euro country adopted its own version of the EAA. So there was this harmonized standard, and yet individual means of enforcement, or, you know, Ireland says they're going to send your executives to prison. You know, other countries say we're going to fine you this many dollars a day. But really, it's about that market pressure where everybody is being told this is the new floor that we all must work on, not that this is some aspirational target or that it's something that we can just afford to ignore. And, you know, that pressure is really what got attention. Now, the difficult part with these kinds of pressure laws is that nobody really pays attention to them until about 3 to 6 months before they go into enactment. And then everybody kind of expects like Armageddon the day they go into force. And when they don't get flooded with letters from the government saying, we found you to be inaccessible on day one, they say, well, maybe it wasn't that big a deal. And really what we know is that those regulators are saying, look, we recognize that you're taking steps, but we want to be there to support you in these early stages. But if you're going to willfully ignore the regulations, we're going to have a very different standard. And so, you know, I think that what companies are seeing now is that they have a lot of users saying, not only I expect you to be accessible, but also I can report you if you are not. and that regulator is going to eventually lose patience with us, you know what? We probably ought to just be working on accessibility so we can do it on our schedule and not on the schedule of a regulator or of a regulation.
And how important is it to have leadership involved? I mean, I know that's a struggle that I've had when I was working in this space, getting leadership on board. How much of an impact does that have when it's coming from, I guess, the top down?
Yeah, you know, I think it for sure is. And what we find is that those who are able to include kind of a centralized approach to accessibility, when they really have that accessibility policy, and not the one on the website that we users encounter when we go to an accessibility page hoping to find who to contact to report something, but instead see this blanket statement of, we strive to meet or exceed WCAG 2.1 AA. And then we all say, well, 2.1, there's been 2.2 for 8 years now. Why are we still talking about 2.1? That centralization of an accessibility policy, that automation that organizations adopt, and ownership, those are the three markers that really make that meaningful difference. So getting leadership on board is what really helps organizations to connect digital accessibility with those organizational priorities, with revenue, with increased user experience, customer satisfaction. But one of the difficulties that organizations will frequently run into with that is the idea that accessibility can't be something that's scalable. So many organizations say, well, we can't just hire more accessibility professionals every time we want to build a new experience. Never mind that those organizations have no problem hiring designers, developers, product managers, agencies, when they want to build that new experience. And so what ends up happening is that it's leadership is needing that one view of digital accessibility across the ecosystem, so that in one place, you can review all of your digital assets for accessibility. What teams are working on this well? What teams still need support? And how do we get those teams connected with each other? But instead, what a lot of teams are doing is they're relying on manual tests, only manual tests, I should say. Manual tests are a good thing, but if you only rely on the manual and you only rely on Excel spreadsheets and PowerPoint presentations of where we were at one point in time when we did an audit, it's really not scaling at this point. And as we, you know, we talk about AI, AI is an important part of bringing all of this together. And leadership loves AI. Leadership thinks AI is going to solve all kinds of issues for us. And it will, but only when it's used responsibly and only when AI is that connective layer between human experts and the software platform that can really bring together all of that data in one place. So we can not only just tell the story once, but at any point in time, we can review how we've been tracking on accessibility and really drill into a specific issue that a user claims to have and say, aha, here is not only the issue the user is having, but here is an AI-suggested code fix from a large language model that's been trained on doing accessibility well and not on the 96% of the internet's top million homepages, which have major accessibility barriers.
I mean, you've probably already answered this, but of course, AI, it is having a huge impact in the software development and the web development industry. How do you think it is changing the way that organizations approach accessibility?
You know, we see organizations expecting more of AI than what AI is capable of doing today when it comes to digital accessibility. And so the scale problem is becoming even greater because organizations are saying, well, we're going to use AI to build this experience. An experience that used to take 6, 12, 18 weeks to build can be done in just a fraction of that time. And we think if we give it the right prompt, if we give it the right buzzword, the tool is going to make sure that experience is accessible. What ends up happening, though, is that the tool inevitably creates an app that's not accessible. And our current process of having humans review that experience and provide feedback, that's happening so slowly in comparison to the speed at which AI is building that we're not able to crack the nut. We're not able to actually attack the debt before more debt is created. What organizations are finding success in is saying, how can I connect the tool that I'm using to build this experience with level access as one example of an AI tool through Model Context Protocol or MCP, right? Connect the AI so they can talk to each other essentially and say, I built this. Hey, level access, what do I need to think about how to make this auto-animating carousel with Ari Alive accessible? And for the LLM to say, the best answer is to not do that. Go back and try again. And then have the design AI come back and say, okay, here's a new thing that I've built. How am I doing for accessibility with this? Well, here are a few tweaks to make. So that's really what's ultimately going to solve this accessibility need, is that we need to be not just AI assisted, but we need an agentic approach to digital accessibility and revolutionize the way that we're doing our testing and delivering our results over time.
It's interesting. I think that sort of thing is starting to come as well, isn't it? I know there's a few organizations working on kind of a, I guess, an accessibility focused AI. I mean, is that something you're starting to see, maybe not out there, but at least, like, do you think that is coming? Do you think that is possible?
The concern I have is that there will be a reliance on users to bring their accessible AI into the experience. So what do I need to do to, why do I need to make my website accessible if you as a user have a screen reader that can walk through and prompt you with the booking flow for your airline ticket? We saw that at CSUN with the JAWS screen reader, right? That it can actually book the ticket for you. Well, we know that that only works if you know exactly what you're looking for. The idea of browsing is still very important. And so, not to mention, us blind folks are really good at learning something once and hoping it's going to work forever.
Yeah.
And I recognize it's a broad statement, but having worked with blind people for more than 30 years, I'm pretty sure and pretty confident in that, right? My friends this weekend were telling me all the reasons they happily don't have smartphones. You know, and while they text and they're able to order an Uber over the phone and they're able to do what they need to do on email, works for them. And so there's a big chance that we're leaving those users behind and relying on the user to be a bit of a code monkey and a geek. And then also for in the workplace environment, you have an employee coming into a workplace that maybe they're understanding only for the first time how this company does business or how this industry works. And yet the expectation is, well, as a blind person, don't you have a tool that can solve this for you? And now we enter the world of security and of privacy, and giving that an even bigger unfair advantage to the blind employee coming in who says, look, I probably could make this job accessible, but I'm going to need some time to experiment and to better understand, which comes from being able to use the same onboarding materials, the same technology that all my coworkers are using, so we can help each other and learn from each other. And that's, I think, the dilemma that we might be creating if we rely too heavily on that assistive technology to be the AI connector between those screen of content and our brain of understanding, that we risk leaving blind folks and others with disabilities behind.
Mm. Interesting times, that's for sure, when it comes to this sort of technology. Here's something that's kind of hard to believe. Global Accessibility Awareness Day is in its 15th year now. And I'm going to be honest, I've always kind of joked a little bit that Global Accessibility Awareness Day, you know, the one day where organizations go, yeah, of course, we really care, we love accessibility. And then the rest of the year, yeah, okay, we'll get to it. But do you think that has changed? Like, how do you think Global Accessibility Awareness Day has changed over the last 15 years that it's been going?
I think Global Accessibility Awareness Day, it can be a great unifier for folks in our accessibility profession. It's lonely out there to be the person that the brand hired, the one individual with no budget, no power, no authority, and no team to tackle accessibility for, you know, tens of thousands of people working in an organization. And so GAD gives us the opportunity, just like an annual trip to an accessibility conference, that jolt in the arm of energy that there are others out there in the space making these same investments day in and day out, that they're having the same struggles, and how can we learn from each other? But I think in this case, what we need is less accessibility awareness and more accessibility practice and accessibility education. That we need teams to understand what is their unique role in digital accessibility. And that I'm excited to see the GAD Foundation is hosting in-person events saying, you can come, yes, but bring somebody who's new to accessibility along with you so that we can get more people to understand what it is that it takes to make an experience more accessible. But really what's ultimately needed, again, whether you get your education through something like the Level Access Academy or another tool, the goal is to make sure that you, in your role, whether you're a designer, developer, although those two roles are designers code and developers design these days, but whatever your role is, that you have the opportunity to get that role-based specific education at the right moment in time that you can actually make meaningful progress. That gone are the days of, you know, an hour-long course or a half-day course on accessibility and the thought that people will do something different afterwards. Those are important kickoff moments. But for us to move the needle on digital accessibility will truly require us to bring that education right to the desktop and right into the IDE of the person who's doing that development in that moment. And that's the kind of thing that I think accessibility is needing now, is not relying on awareness or not relying on questions, but really relying on what is the practice and how does that affect you in your day-to-day work.
So if people want to learn more about Level Access and about the work that they do, where can they go and how can they get in touch with you?
I would say we are levelaccess.com. I'm the only CORB that I know of on the internet, CORBB. I'm both the president of the National Federation of the Blind of Minnesota, as well as director of thought leadership at Level Access. And, you know, I think what our focus really is on saying, how do we help brands evolve and be more accessible and operationalize the work of digital accessibility? So I'd personally love to be in touch with listeners, and also as an organization, you know, as people are thinking about building something new or revamping their existing experience to make it more accessible, we're here to be a partner in that, especially with our team that's based in Europe.
Fantastic. Well, Corb, enjoy Global Accessibility Awareness Day. I'm sure it will be a busy time for you guys, but it's been a really interesting conversation. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Time again here on RNIB Connect Radio to browse through some of the products that you can find on shop.rnib.org.uk/connect. And Charlie Jarvis, RNIB Shop's Buying Administrator, joins me now to tell me about the Hable speech labels. Hello, Charlie. How are you?
Hello, I'm very good. Thank you for having me.
This time we are chatting about what sounds like a great way to label items around your home and your clothes too, making sure that you are not wearing black and blue, which I think is a bit of a fashion no-no from what people tell me. So, Charlie, tell me a bit more about the Hable speech labels, as I think all you need is an app on your smartphone and to buy some of the QR code labels too to get started labeling things.
Absolutely. So the app is available on Apple and Android and is completely free to download. And then each label has an individual QR code on it. And each pack of labels comes in different sizes. So you can get small or large. You can also get a button that you can sew into your clothes that can go through the washing machine for your laundry. And they're not sequential. So essentially, you can record onto each individual label whatever you want to say, whether that be your shampoo and conditioner or your tins of beans versus custard, because nobody wants to get those mixed up. And then you don't have to buy the packs in sequence. So each label is individual. And you just buy as many or as little as you need.
Yeah, and I think this is really good because I have a lot of items around my home that have Braille labels on them, which works really well. But I do like the idea of having an audio label, you know, so that as well as saying what an item is, like the colour of my shirt or something like that, but also to be able to record other information like what trousers that shirt might go with too. So I think these are really good.
Absolutely. And I mean, you can also do it with use by dates and things like that. So you can record what's in the tin and then say when it goes out of date, and you've got all the information then in one play.
Yeah, because I think that's really good because, of course, you know, you can use OCR, you know, apps to scan items and labels, but having that extra audio information to tell you a little bit more about, say, a food product, how to cook with it, what other food products that might go with, I think works really well.
I think it's a fantastic option. And with the tech-based solution as well, with the app already being available to download, it's completely free. So once you've bought the labels, you're all good to go, really.
So, Charlie, tell me a little bit more about the Habel speech label range of products and the cost of the QR code labels too.
So we have a starter pack that's got assorted labels in it. So it's a mixture of the small and the large, and that is £16. Then we have a pack of the smaller labels that contains 100 labels, and that's £18. And then we have a pack of the larger labels, which contains 25, and that's £18. And then we have the buttons for laundry that contains 25 buttons, and that's £26.
Well, to find out more about the Habel speech labels and many more products in the RNIB online shop, do go to shop.rnib.org.uk/connect. Well, thank you so much indeed, Charlie, for chatting with me here on RNIB Connect Radio and telling me more about the Habel speech labels.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
The popular accessible technology fair Site Village makes its way to Leeds in June. Here to explain more is Site Village Events Manager Rose Woodall. Rose, welcome back to RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you very much. It don't seem 5 minutes since I spoke to you last time.
No, that's what happens with a busy year.
As we spoke earlier, 6 events this year, so extremely busy.
Well, what can we expect from the next one, Site Village in Leeds? Who will be there?
Yeah, so we haven't been there since 2024, so we're looking forward to going back. It's proving to be very popular. We have some local, we have some of our regulars. So we have Humanware, Thomas Pocklington, who's sponsor. Guide Dogs will be there, Macula Society. And then we've got some locals to Leeds. So we've got Your Sensory, Leeds Sensory Service Bid, Outlook, and South Yorkshire Visually Impaired Tennis Club. That's just a few. If you go on the website, we've got a lot of exhibitors at this one.
For people who might have heard all about Site Village exhibitions previously, but not been to one yet, what are they like?
Yeah, so it's a great event. It really is. And it's, you know, nowadays, we don't get a lot of that face-to-face, and it really is vibrant. Come along, talk to people face-to-face, try out the equipment, ask any questions, and everyone's there to sort of help you solve them problems face-to-face. So it's a really good, you know, it's a really good event. You can purchase refreshments. It's free. You can stay there for the whole day. There will be seminars, but that is slightly being updated on the website at the moment. So there's always a lot going on. So it's really worth a visit.
And you mentioned those seminars. Lots of talks obviously going on throughout the day in Leeds from experts. What can we expect there?
Yeah, so I'm currently working on the seminars. I won't say too much about them because they're slightly being updated, but they'll be updated within the next week. But there will be, again, at Exeter, we didn't have many seminars, but Leeds seems a lot more popular, a lot more people wanting to do a range of discussions on different topics. So, yeah, keep checking the website and they'll be up on there.
Are there any products or services that are going to be displayed this year in Leeds that you're especially interested in maybe learning about yourself?
You know what? I'm always surprised myself when I go there. We have got new exhibitors coming. So it's really great that once everyone gets us out the table set up, you go round and, you know, myself as the manager as well, it's really good for me to sort of keep updated on technology, services. And when people ring, I can give advice. So, I'm not quite sure. I can't name one at the moment, but I'm sure when I get there, as always, I'm surprised.
Tickets are free to all Site Village exhibitions, but you can book in advance.
Yes, yeah, so we do recommend. You don't have to, so I don't want people to feel they need to, because you can turn up on the day. But we just ask if you come in with groups or you want to get through registration quicker, they can email us on sv@qac.ac.uk. They can go onto our website, which is www.qacsitevillage.org.uk. On there will be the list of the venues for 2026. you'll be able to click on leads and there'll be a button that you can click on to book your tickets. So you can book how many tickets you want. We have tickets so we know how many people are coming, but as I did state, it is a free event to visit.
And this, of course, isn't the last Site Village exhibition of the year. 2026 has been very busy, as we've already mentioned, and there's even more events to come after Leeds.
Yeah, so just literally pretty much a month after Leeds, and then we've got our flagship Central. So there's lots going on, lots being booked for that, exciting things going on there. Then for the first time ever, we're going to be in North Wales, so we're going to be in Llandudno, working alongside the Society for the Blind. So we're sort of collaborating a little bit on there. So that one's really exciting. And then the end of October, so slightly a little bit earlier, we'll be back in London for the 2-day event. So non-stop this year. So, you know, wherever you are in the UK, try and come to one of our events. It would be great.
We'll look forward to hearing more about those upcoming events later this year. Site Village Leeds takes place on Tuesday, the 2nd of June from 9 a.m. until 3 p.m. at the Royal Armouries in Leeds. Rose Riddle, Site Village Events Manager, thanks very much for joining us on RNIB Connect Radio.
Okay, and fantastic as always. Thank you.
And that is us done for another week. Thank you so much, as always, for joining us. And if you've got anything that you want to share or any questions or any feedback, get in touch. techtalk@rnib.org.uk. You're always welcome to send in a written message or attach a voice note. We'll be back with you same time, same place next week. But from me, Callum Stoneman, Hubert Pavalkovic, Jackie Brown and Natalie Curran, bye for now.
Goodbye.
Bye for now.
Bye.
Bye.